Okay, James.
Have you warmed up, Bruno?
Oh, no, I haven't. Did you listen to the vocal coach one? We're supposed to be sat with our feet firmly on the ground, straight back. And
mummy, no.
Exactly.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled pepper. Okay.
Okay, we're good. We're sorted.
Hello, Sarah and Mark, and welcome to the Making Theatre podcast. Where are you joining us from today?
Macclesfield. Macclesfield is South Manchester.
Yes, I'm in the dining room and Sarah's in the lounge.
Excellent. And is the sun out?
The sun isn't out. Our biggest concern is that the tortoise is going to wake up. He will be after Mark's feet through the whole of the podcast.
He's going to stay in his basket for a little while.
So that'll be a podcast first, a bit of live tortoise action.
Very, very risky.
He's a rescue tortoise.
He was fed on beef burgers, apparently, which is not a great thing.
Is that why he wants your feet?
Yeah, well, that's why he wants my feet and why he's enormous.
No, it's because your feet smell of beef burgers. That's why.
Thanks, yeah, a little personal insight there.
Well, we now have a perfect visual picture for all the listeners.
It would have been so much easier if the sun had been out.
It would. We could have just said, yes, it is.
That's set the tone, isn't it? Great.
Nothing like a tangent.
Would be plenty of those, I think. Anyway, so today we're going to talk about making pantomime because you are a particularly perky panto producing partnership.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
You're both veterans of the pantomime scene. Your production of Robin Hood at the Liverpool Everyman won Best Panto and Best Musical Direction at the Great British Pantomime Awards this year. Congratulations, that must have been nice.
Thank you very much.
It was amazing. It really was amazing.
And you've been responsible for 19 years of hugely successful pantomime at the Liverpool Everyman, which is something we will talk about later. But before we do that, could you just maybe both outline your first encounters with panto? Can you remember the first time you saw one?
I think I was about 4, and it was Babes in the Woods, and I cried all the way through it. And my family and my cousins, and I was a youngster, and I don't know, I was completely freaked out by it. I don't know why. I'm not such a big fan of Babes in the Woods.
PTSD, obviously.
Yeah.
I remember mine really, really clearly. I mean, I was very lucky. I saw Danny LaRue do it and John Inman do it. And I think one of my most extraordinary things was Ronnie Corbett at Davenport Theatre. He had a routine where they got the dads to come up and have a horse race, basically, on these, what were basically hobby horses. And the dads would sit on the rocking horses and rock across stage. And my dad went up.
He's very competitive.
He's very competitive. He got on this horse, and one of them was a rigged horse, basically. So all of them went forward except my dad's, which went backwards. I remember it being the most joyous, funny thing I had ever seen. I was like, and my dad was so determined to win it. He kept going up into the wings, and then they'd have to bring him back on. Just fantastic. I've always remembered that huge amount of laughter at it.
I bet Ronnie Corbett was amazing.
He was amazing. He was absolutely brilliant.
So would you say that you're panto nerds and fans of pantos before you started writing them, or has your interest evolved with the writing?
Because we've both been in pantos as actors, and sometimes they've not been the most challenging parts. I'd often be the fairy, and traditionally fairies speak in rhyming couplets, which is fine, but it's quite limiting. So as soon as we started to write them, particularly in Liverpool, all the kind of elements of panto that we were too keen on, we just kind of dropped and then started to veer off and not make such stereotypical characters. And so our fairy would be quite kooky, have real feelings, have real dilemmas.
She was kind of like another heroine, wasn't she?
Yeah, very positive, very strong women. And I think for us, as we have actors' heads on when we write, we want each part, or each character rather, that you just get, I'd want to act that character. So that's kind of quite key, whether we're writing a genie, whether we're writing Robin Hood, the heroine, that they'd have proper obstacles to overcome. And they'd have their own brand of humour as well, because, you know, who wants to be the straight guy? You kind of are the straight guy, but you can have your own humour as well.
How important is the plot in that?
Well, people who know us would just go,
what?
Plot? We would go, no, there is a very, very real story going on that is only known to me and Mark.
It's a funny thing, because if you look at a traditional panto, I mean, obviously, you've got the elements that everyone knows are coming. But it seemed to us as ridiculous as, you know, having an international ice skater who happens to live in the town and you bring him on to be buttons or whatever. And you have a whole sequence of him ice skating for no apparent reason. things like that just seemed great. Also, yeah. Well, why not put Rapunzel? She's got long hair and it's so long she can climb into space or whatever. You know, it just seemed to me that it was a springboard to go anywhere. I mean, those elements at Liverpool, we made a conscious decision there to kind of go away from the traditional things to make it a bit more modern, I suppose. Because I think there are so many elements of panto that are questionable in the world that we're in now.
Yeah, so you're sort of pulling on the sort of traditions and tropes of panto that somehow we're all culturally aware of. And I guess you were very aware of before you started writing. Would you go as far to say that there are rules in how you put together a panto script?
I think people would definitely say that, but then, you know, we've seen those rules and broken them and just kind of done our own thing. But I think it's partly because we had a young family that are growing up. And what really thrills me is our teenagers will still want to go and see the Liverpool show. So you're kind of going, it has to keep modernising and updating without it being, I mean, we don't do politics in it because we're kind of thinking that's not for everybody and everybody's politics are different. And it really is to take you on a flight of fantasy.
We have very clear definitions of who the funnies are and who the storytellers are. And they tend to stick to those things. So those things are quite rigid. But like you said, Bruno, we are taking tropes of panto and just seeing what you can do with them and how you can do it. We wrote for Oldham Coliseum, which had an incredible history of panto and the tradition of it. And the director said to us, you know, break the rules at your peril. There has to be a slosh scene or there has to be it's behind you and all those kind of things. And at Liverpool, we had the freedom where actually we don't need to have 10 minutes of the audience shouting, oh, yes, it is, oh, no, it is, because it felt to us like we'd run out of story.
Then what we would do is to say something like that. So go, well, okay, but that's audience participation. So we would make it our own audience participation. Yeah. We had an amazing experience. So it's, I don't know whether you have heard of the troll song. There we go. And we got the audience to do it back. And so it felt really musical, the whole audience doing that troll. Years later, I needed this small operation on my hand. I was like literally waiting for the anaesthetist to just do what he had to do. And I just kind of went, oh, I'm a little bit nervous. And he just said, oh, can I just, let's just see what you, oh, it's, you're a writer, are you? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, where do you write? So I said, well, I've been writing with my partner at the Liverpool Everyman Rock and Roll Panto. And he went, here I am in Macclesfield Hospital. Light is far reaching.
Then you went to sleep to his dulcet.
Yeah. No, he put me to sleep. Tra-la-la-la-laring to me.
Amazing.
When we've done other more traditional things for venues elsewhere, we have to go back to what the original thing is and what those people know to start with. Where we are at Liverpool, the show we did last year, we couldn't put that anywhere else. It just wouldn't work anywhere else. It's something specific for Liverpool. You know, it has been a great privilege that we've had those 19 years to develop our own style.
So what's your rule of thumb for a gag? How do you know what's going to land, what's going to be funny? Do you just play it on each other and see what makes you laugh?
Yeah. No, very much that. And I think because we don't really do jokes, I mean, that's probably because I don't understand them. It's more character humour, situational humour, storyline humour.
We've also been really lucky because we've worked with two actors for many, many years who are both incredibly idiosyncratic performers.
Right. And do you write with them in mind, knowing they're going to be in the show?
Absolutely.
Because we are actors, that really helps in the writing. So as soon as we get our storyline, we can hear their voices and we can write to their rhythms and their inflections. And like one of the characters is incredibly verbose but makes up a lot of his words. And that's just been a thing that's grown over the years. And
He does it brilliantly.
He does.
Absolutely extraordinary. And so the more we've worked with him, the more we've got how he speaks. So he's the kind of funny person for the day.
Yeah.
And as it's developed over the years, the Dane got less and less plot to carry and was just making points. obviously the other actor was having to carry a lot of the plot, was finding it really infuriating that he'd do all these monologues and
and so do you have catchphrases that travel from year to year, obviously in Liverpool? I mean, do the audience recognise that? They know the history and therefore they're looking forward to certain things that are likely to happen.
Yes,
one of our favourite ones was, again, talking of this actor, that one of our favourite ones, you'd get into some plight and then you'd have a thing of going, and so my nightmare comes again. And they would play the Psycho sting.
And everything would go red.
Weep, 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 weep. But everybody just became this really stupid thing.
Mark, you and I both had experience of pantomime at Nottingham Playhouse in slightly different ways. I mean, in that you were the dame and I was stage electrics backstage. But I remember the first year I did it, and Kenneth Ellen Taylor was the dame, who also he was the director and the writer. But I remember him arriving on stage for the first time and the place going wild before he'd said a word. And then he sort of arrived downstage center, and then eventually the crowd would subside, and then he just went, "Here I am, dears," and they went wild again. Yeah. They just were waiting for it. It was incredible. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, he was extraordinary. He made a wonderful dame to watch him learn from. It's incredible. And we have a thing, you know, the water routine is quite a common thing in panto, where someone will come out with water pistols and they'll squirt the audience and everything else. So we kind of played on that, and they come out now with super soakers. And it's not that they stand on stage squirting them from afar. They actually go into the audience and actually will empty the whole barrel into someone's trousers or something, you know. That's become such a thing. We will clamp the word water in a scene, and there will be a ripple amongst the audience, and people will then get their umbrellas out, put on raincoats. They know it's coming. And we've had people with shower caps on, and people come with their own water pistols, and, you know,
they're sort of complicit, actually, in that case.
They're complicit, 100%. Yeah.
But we have another bit now. The audience participation thing is a thing, because we bring someone from the audience up onto stage, and like you do, you know, it's a common thing. But the actors say, "No, it's everyone's favourite bit," and the audience shout back, "The audience participation."
Fantastic.
And we don't know where that's come from or why that's happened.
They actually say the audience participation.
Yeah,
the audience shouting out.
Amazing.
It's incredible.
I was going to ask you if you tailor the panto to the local audience. I think you've answered that very, very comprehensively.
It's quite extraordinary. There's a place in Liverpool called Fazakerley. And if somebody says exactly, someone in the audience will shout out, "Exactly."
Amazing.
And it is inclusive, isn't it? That's what's joyous about it.
But it's a party. You know, it's a party.
Yeah. So if it's tailored to the local audience, that obviously contributes to that sense of it being specifically for those people, and that has a great deal of mileage. But if you're selling scripts to other theatres in other regions, you have to adapt them. And do you have to go to get to know the place if you don't know it already?
So if we were asked to write for a different city, we'd want to make it really local to them, and so the audience feels it's absolutely for them. So that's really important to get local references in.
And you've done many years of pandas in the same place, and you've got with the same team many people with familiar faces coming back. When you've worked in other venues, have you had a similar collaborative process, or is it slightly harder because you're less familiar with the individuals?
Basically, at Liverpool, Mark's directed them.
Yeah.
So then that keeps it absolutely as we see it in our heads. If it's just a script, then we don't really have a say on casting. You know, you do have to hand them over.
Yes.
Also, those ones we've written for other theatres have been much more traditional.
Yeah.
So much more straightforward, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time we've been asked to go in to write, and we don't know what's gone wrong necessarily, but we've been asked to write something to a set that exists.
Yeah, okay.
But that's a very different way of writing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
So we're literally told the locations, we're told the mechanics, so it kind of dictates. So we can still put our stamp on it, but it's very, very different to us creating locations.
Mm. And so those times, it's been a little bit more challenging for us to go back to those structural things, you know.
We had a lovely one that we wrote for Stratford East, and the poster had been designed before we were on board as writers. And it was a picture of Sleeping Beauty waking up in Tokyo. We're like, "Oh, okay, this is really interesting." You know, the starting point was the poster. So she wakes up in this high-tech world. And then actually, once we got our heads around it, it was real fun. It was just a different way of writing.
Can I ask about your writing technique? Because I think it's quite unusual in some ways.
Yes. So basically, I can't create in front of a screen. I'm obviously the problematic one in a writer relationship. But I can create walking. So I literally walk Mark for miles till he begs me to sit down.
Make it stop, please. Make it stop.
We're really lucky we've got a canal near us. And so we have a little recorder. And then I think just like as actors, you can start to bounce the ideas around. We'll put it down on the recorder. And then when we get back, one of us will type it up.
We get some very, very funny looks on the canal. Before we go, we're doing Act 2, Scene 3 or whatever. And we'll know what the structure of that is, who's in it when you come on and off and all those kind of things. And then, so we'll know how it goes from A to B, basically. and then we'll go on a, you know, maybe a 20-mile hike. I don't know what you think, Sarah, but, you know, towards the 19th mile, it's not quite as funny as it was at the start.
It's lucky you live in such a beautiful part of the world.
No. But equally, you know, creativity is a really strange one. You can't just turn it on.
19 miles of nothingness.
But equally, we're by water, so it is actually really calming and you're outdoors. And I think it's a really decent environment to throw around the ideas.
Yeah.
I imagine it's part
of the process as well, isn't it? Sometimes you have to go through those moments of sort of fallow period, as it were, before the ideas start to come. But you're essentially improvising, are you, when you're writing?
Yeah.
You record it and then you build the script from the improvised recordings.
Yes.
Dialogue's an easy thing for us because obviously we'll just put our actors' heads in it. So the kind of structure, the A to Bs, so we can keep it kind of very tight. Sometimes when you start off and it's an idea, you use an awful lot of words because you're just trying to get that idea. So it's important that we just keep going back, writing it up, taking it away. Mm. So we hone it down till it's particularly at the beginning of writing one.
Mm. I think one of the nice things about it is as well, it feels like it's quite improvised, even though it isn't.
No, it isn't.
But it does feel like they're making it up on the spur of the moment, because I think it comes from the fact that when Sarah and I have been playing the part, we have to listen to what the other person's saying.
Right.
In it, you know, and I actually should do in every piece of it. You know, but it gets to the stage where that doesn't necessarily always happen. And I think one of the things that does happen in traditional pantos quite often is you're on autopilot because you're having to do 70 shows and look or whatever they're squeezing in. And so it becomes sort of automatic. And we didn't want that at all because we wanted it. So the actors have to always be on the ball. It kind of forces them to be listening all the time, which I think is something that I really like about the process of doing it improvising like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you're saying that when you hit the rehearsal room and the cast get their hands on the script, does it evolve? Do they improvise on top of it?
No, not really. It's really interesting, but there's an internal rhythm to it. Mm. So as soon as somebody drops the ball, like Mark said, they're not listening or they're using extra long pauses. But equally, if they start adding extra material, it just tips the scene. So once we've written the script, we will then read it aloud as actors. And you can instantly edit, just go, we don't need that, because you can hear that something's outstayed its welcome.
And
generally speaking, you know, it is something that we want those actors to just go, oh my word, I love saying these lines. And so they are fired up into the characters. And I think at the same time, it's like with the music, we like to push the music. So the musical director is absolutely fired up. The same with the designer. We have an amazing designer for the last 13 years, and that she brings like so much to the table from all the crazy characters we've done. And that very much is like a collaborative process. And the same with, you know, going into wardrobe, that we feel it should be absolutely a genre that excites everybody.
Yeah.
And it's not predictable.
Over the last two decades, it's evolved your writing style, clearly. But I just wanted to ask you again about the tension between the script that you write and take into the rehearsals. And you said that you're quite strict with them about that, in rehearsals at least. But there's also this sense that you've written a script that sounds like it's improvised because people obviously respond very well to that. They get the sense that they're watching something unique. And that's a big part of your pantomime experience, isn't it? And I was intrigued because with Mark as Dame, I remember that the script was more of a guideline, I would say, rather than...
except when Kenneth was in.
Except when Kenneth was in, yeah. But how important are improvisational skills? How important is it to be able to speak?
Yeah.
Let me say that again.
Good luck, James.
How important are improvisational skills? Do you encourage improvisation at the same time as sort of asking them to stick to the structure?
It's really important to us that script is tight and it keeps that rhythm. Because if everybody started ad-libbing, then we get really flabby and then the story is getting diluted. But for us, if we've done our job rightly, the actors love what they're saying anyway, and they're naturally funny and there's no need for them to ad-lib on top of it. It is tight.
I mean, I think as well, because the story isn't necessarily the story that people might be coming to expect. So those kind of plot moments need to be hit. So we understand how we've ended up in space. That those kind of key things have to be adhered to. We have had things where it's become too much. And like something funny might happen over there and that becomes the focus of everything. And then we forget why we've got space. So there have to be reins on it somewhere. But at the same time, there has to be the freedom that you can have those moments if somebody shouts something out to you, that you go off that way. But I think that's one of the things that's developed over the years, that there's an understanding of where those moments are.
So when we did Robin Hood, we'd got, I think, probably a core of 5 or 6 actors who were very familiar with our work. The ones who knew our work well were just jumping to play in these array of characters and, you know, entering this kind of slightly bizarre world. And the new people who were asked to play, I think we said previously, trolls, they were cowboys, they were mermaids, and just freshly out of drama school, and they'd done their Brecht and their Stanislavski, just going, there is another way of acting, and you can be these fantastical characters, yet you can still bring all your acting skills into doing it. Because like Mark said, you know, they have to be based in truth. And if they're based in truth, then the audience can be transported.
Yes.
Well, yeah, so last year, a couple of the characters that the newbies played was Bill and Ben, the flowerpot men. And number one, if you'd heard us on the canal, flobber-dobbing.
The famous Bill and Ben scene in Robin Hood.
Yeah, I remember it well.
I mean, if anybody had filmed us in the rehearsal room, we'd be like, no, it's like flobber-dobber-dob. Flobber-dob. Flobber-dobber-dob.
And because they're young as well, so they wouldn't...
And they're really young, so they've never seen it. And so they're kind of like, oh, right, okay, flobber-dobber-dob. No. I don't think Bill would kind of say it like that. I think it's more like flobber-dobber-dob. All right.
What's my motivation?
Yeah.
But we did. We went into all that. We did actually go into all that because it helps.
So when all their flobber-dobs, they knew exactly what they were saying because there was like other lines with their intention, which helped.
We quite often in rehearsal room have a thing that the script doesn't really give you a security blanket other than each other. So you have to trust each other, and the lines that you are delivering have to be done right. So that's the security blanket, that if you deliver that line, that amount of energy and that kind of precision, the next person can bat it back, and you always keep the ball up in the air.
If it's all too loose, I imagine the whole thing could fall to pieces very quickly.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, because it's a challenge. You don't get your Bill and Ben class at drama school, you know. So it takes careful handling. And if you've got somebody who says, this is just too ridiculous, then you're in trouble. You'd have to find a way of coaxing that out of people. And also, not only have they got those kind of things to deal with, they've also got praying as well, that they'll be on the bandstand, then they're on stage.
Oh yes, because they're all acting musicians, aren't they?
So there's a huge amount of information they're having to take on. I think when we first started, we didn't think we'd find people who could do all this.
It's a very particular skill set, isn't it? I mean, also a very broad skill set.
Yeah.
I mean, the standard of musicianship's really, really high. Then obviously they can sing, they can dance, and they're fantastic actors. So it really is a kind of niche.
Actors are extraordinary, though, aren't they? Really. I'm always constantly in awe of what they can do.
We have one actress who played 9 instruments.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's amazing.
She played all 9 during the course of the show.
If we can. Yeah. I think there's an equity thing now. It's slightly different where you can only play 3 or something. Yeah, if... In the old days, we'd try and get people who played at least 4 or 5 things. And if anyone was ill, the band would sound the same. It was extraordinary. Somebody said, well, I can jump on, I'll play that. I'll pick up sax and have a go. And it was amazing.
Part of the spectacle as well, I guess.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
But the other thing to put into the equation is that in an acting musician show, those actors are on stage the whole time. So they might have done their scenes, they've sung a rock song, and then they've gone back, they're playing the drums or whatever. Then they're back on the playing stage.
And they're not usually doing costume change as well. So it's an incredibly busy show.
So with the music, when you're writing, you must be involved in choosing the songs.
Yeah.
So you sort of hang the songs on certain moments. Does that get really complicated with rights and things like that? Does that become problematic?
We have to put in PRS quite early once we know. You have to put in a list of and how long. So how long you guess each song's going to be. Which obviously you don't really know until you're in rehearsal. But we try and have a good idea. So we never have a song that's over 2.5 minutes, even if it's a popular classic. But there's things like, you know, you can never do Disney. You're not just Disney's off the table. You won't get the rights. And things like, if ABBA's on, say Mamma Mia, if it's around in the town or anything else, the rights of those just go. And so things like that. There's certain songs where you think, you know, you've got an inkling. That
you sort of have a feeling of what might work or what might not.
Yeah. And particularly over the years that we know there's so much just surefire winners, you know.
We always have a little nod to children's television. It goes back to the 60s and the 50s. We always have like Man in a Suitcase or Captain Scarlet music or Thunderbirds or something that weave in and out throughout the
integral
story.
To the story.
Obviously, integral to the story.
Integral. So I guess you got a sense of what music is going to be culturally, culturally is the wrong word. I guess culturally relevant, but also something that a lot of generations can listen to and react to and know, I suppose.
That's the key thing, I think, yeah.
If you get that number right, that spans the generations, like one way or another that Blondie did, and I think it's One Direction did, you can absolutely unite people in a big populist music. And that's been our job, is going, how do you unite that audience that might have four-year-olds in it, teenagers, you know, 20-year-olds, the office party, the grandparents? And that's kind of really key to what we write.
Mm. So would you say that uniting an audience in that way is what the appeal of panto and panto writing is to you?
I think so. And I think it's, you know, it breaks the fourth wall and reaches out to people. I think you can just be transported. It can be escapism. I mean, that's particularly what we've done. We've gone off in flights of fantasy.
There's also a huge amount of fun. The sheer stupidity of what it is at its very heart. I think it's that. And if you can sit on that roller coaster of stupidity, which I think would be fair to say that we've done, haven't we, Seth?
That would be fair to say.
I'm getting the sense that it's quite a time-consuming business, this. Is it like a year-round job for you guys?
We sort of get going February, March.
Wow. Is it ever difficult to get into a pantomime frame of mind in mid-August?
Oh, yeah, no, that's fine. I think it's partly because we have the kids so young that we'll be on the beach in August and we'll be like just oblivious to people around us. And as I say, if you could hear our conversations.
Brilliant.
Once we've got the idea of where it's going to go, There's quite a lot of time convincing everyone else this is a good idea.
And so do you write design ideas into the script?
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, I think as well, because we're visual thinkers. I mean, people laugh at our stage directions because it would be painting the world. Yeah, they could just go, you could write essays in your stage directions. But it's us informing the designer, you know, the sound guy, lighting, exactly what we'd want.
It's not completely dictatorial.
Yes.
I mean, within those things, there are things that we might envisage that are actually technically impossible to do.
Sure. So it's a springboard for ideas.
It's a springboard for ideas, very much so. I mean, there is the thing where we'll say, this is what we'd like to happen. Is it possible? Can we do something like this? We don't know. In Rapunzel, we wanted her to swing across the stage on her hair, and she had 40 meters of hair that was made in the wardrobe, and there were people plaiting for days and days getting this long, long piece of hair, which we then had attached to the product when we were at the Playhouse, and she could swing from one side of the stage to the other on her hair. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing, and it took us a long, long time to work out if that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then she ran around the back of the stage and the hair carried on, and it just got longer and longer and longer. Then, of course, that's completely impractical. And so she had a haircut, and so our Rapunzel had a bob, but we'd shown that she had very, very long hair. And for me, the fact that everyone went with that idea was just an extraordinary thing.
So what we would do is going, what are those elements of Rapunzel we need to do? So we both went, she's got to have long hair. And then practically going, but we can't have an actress like with super long hair who's going to be playing her instruments, getting up on the bandstand. And that's how we hit upon this idea, going, what if we show her with this like massive long hair? Narrative-wise, she gets stuck in a tree and her dad has to get these shears and cut the hair, but that's all off stage. So she's going, Dad, help, I'm stuck in the tree. Oh, don't worry, darling, I'll cut your hair and free you. And then in soft, slow motion, she comes on with this like really gorgeous hairstyle. That's short, but it suited us. But also, you know, we've done the long hair bit. I mean, that's for us is going, how do we solve this? Yeah. How do we, you know?
It's a major collaboration with your set designer. Your technical rehearsals must be something to behold, I think.
Well, yes. And we've had a number of things like that where it's going to take a lot of work. But people come into the tech knowing that there are going to be moments that will be slightly more challenging than others.
How do you manage the tech? Does it feel like a step backwards in a way, in that you've lost the flow you had in the rehearsal room, you have to work through all these sort of tricky technical things? Is it a big leap of faith? Do you sort of worry that it's never going to happen?
The actors instinctively know their journey and their tracks. And there'll be signs where that might be tricky. It might be tricky to get out of a dress that's made of suitcases into a banana costume. That might be an area where we have a jam somewhere.
Yeah.
So we'll work out what we need to do in case.
I guess that sounds fantastic is that you've got the control because you are the writers and directors. So you should go, okay, I know I can make space for this to work if we give everyone a couple of days to sort it out. We'll move on and come back to it.
Yeah.
And,
Yes. But the tech tends to be, The techs are long.
And typically, how many days would you have to take one of your Christmas shows?
A week.
A week of tech. And then how many previews?
Normally about six.
Yeah.
Which is quite good, actually, because like Miles just said, you know, the tech's massive. The, everybody who's working on it, then they do get a Sunday rest because it is
it's full crucial. On.
Yes. Full on, yeah. And by the end of the first week, they're absolutely exhausted. And it's full on, you know, it's full on.
It requires a very high degree of physical and mental fitness, right? And stamina.
Yeah.
Stamina.
Yeah.
I've been on a couple of times. If someone's been ill, I've ended up going on. And it's exhausting. I've done maybe three shows. That's it.
not eight in a week or three in a day or whatever you have to do.
Yeah. Doing it, you know, 70 odd performances. It's extraordinary, you know, absolutely extraordinary the amount of stamina they've got. It's astonishing.
So moving on a bit. I feel that pantomime and Christmas shows are crucial to the UK theatre industry on so many levels, partly for box office theatre income. They introduce families and children to theatre quite often for the first time. There are a huge amount of employment and training for actors, technicians, designers. And I guess because of all of this, it needs to be a hit. Do you feel that weight of responsibility when you write? Do you worry you may put people off theatre for life?
You just can't listen to that voice go, what if last year's was the best one we've gotten? It's what if we can't write anything?
Yeah.
And when we have those walks down the canal and there's the silence thing going on because there's nothing coming in. And if you think of the responsibility going, oh gosh, this is our 19th show and it's got to be up there. And particularly last year, you know, we've been postponed. Oh my word, Robin Hood has better be good.
Yeah, it's tough, that sort of thought.
Yeah, it can be, but it's. I think it's really important not to think on that and just have that ultimate belief and faith.
We're both really aware that it is people's first visit to the theatre. And so the importance of that is paramount for us, that actually every element of theatre and its possibility is done as well as it can be. So the lighting is astonishing, beautiful and magical, and the costumes are exquisite and beautifully made. All those elements, we try and make as magical as possible.
I mean, it is a responsibility, you know, and I think that's the thing. We'd never, ever, when we write them, take them for granted, go back to old scripts. We just keep creating a new one, and that keeps it fresh for us as writers and keep pushing ourselves. And like I say, not listening to the voice that might be going, oh my God, you've got no ideas this year.
This one sucks.
Yeah. Oh, let's admire that other bird over there.
As we're talking about this, I'm getting a lot of flashbacks to those pantos in Nottingham, and there's a very particular smell of pyro smoke and sweets and the roar of the grease paint or the stick of the crowd. I'm getting quite nostalgic. Listen, I have to ask you this because, and tell me if you're not happy to talk about it, but after 19 years, the new Everyman management has decided not to ask you back this year.
Yes.
And I have absolutely no doubt that you will be snapped up, or if you haven't been already, but also knowing you both a little, that you're both extremely positive and you'll be looking to the future rather than dwelling on that. But if you're happy to do so, can you talk a little bit about how that felt? Because as freelancers who kept the theatre full every panto season, it must be pretty awful to be so unceremoniously dropped. I think it was by email.
It was by email. It was by email, 5 o'clock on a Friday in the middle of March. And obviously, because we'd won these awards, we're riding high, just going, oh my gosh. And Robin Hood, you know, it's a particular favourite story of mine anyway, but had been a joyous experience. We'd all worked so tightly together and it was a really, really happy show. We knew new artistic management was coming in, but just receiving an email at 5 o'clock on a Friday in the middle of March was literally pulling the rug from underneath our feet.
Yeah.
And we're freelancers through and through. But I think the hardest thing is that as writers and a director from the same household, that's hugely difficult. Mm. And when it sort of got out into the kind of theatre world, a couple of producers have said, you know, if we'd known you guys for free, we would have booked you this Christmas. But obviously, theatres have to plan their season in advance. So this year's difficult.
Why couldn't they have let you have the 20th anniversary and then do it, then finish?
I just don't know. And they've got another theatre up in the Everyman, and there's the Playhouse.
And the Playhouse struggles as well winter and Christmas. It struggles because it
doesn't have an established show.
It's a difficult venue, all in all, I think.
So just to clarify for people who don't know, that management runs those two venues, doesn't it?
Yes.
Is that still the case? Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's easy to me that would be something that could, go in and make sure there's something exquisite at the Playhouse, keep the cash cow 20th year, and then hand it over. Hand it over. Everyone then celebrates. Everyone's happy.
Yeah. And crucially, you'd have time to plan ahead. I think this is a really pertinent issue because we've become so much more aware since the lockdown how all of these buildings and institutions rely on freelancers. And in most cases, in actual fact, theatres only survive, really, if they employ freelancers on essentially an exploitative basis. They can't really afford to employ people properly. The designers, directors and their ilk are all essentially exploited in order to make the shows. And you must feel a bit, what's the worth of this if you can be dropped so easily?
We very much write from the heart. We're not, we're not driven by money. We obviously like some money, but that's not what we're driven by. We're driven more by creativity, making the theatre work, and we're putting our heart and soul in it. And so not to give us a heads up, that was very, very difficult because Christmas is a big thing. So as far as we're concerned, that Christmas would have been decided way before the middle of March. But if we had got a heads up, we would have just went, oh, okay, yes, we're freelancers, we get it. And, we would have then had a different feel as we kind of watched Robin Hood, and we would have, had the opportunity to say goodbye to that audience who we've known for 19 years, and our kids have grown up with it. It is a very big part of us.
Because 19 years is a long time, and we've had 19 years of very close working relationship. If there'd been problems between us and creative departments or anything else, you'd be given a red flag, something's not right. And I think we would, Sarah and I would have said, this isn't working, we've lost touch, whatever, nobody's enjoying it anymore, it's time to draw a line on it.
Yeah.
But because that wasn't happening and there was no question, there was no tension, it was just it's a well-oiled car, over 19 years working with the same creativity. And I think that can happen after 19 years of that closeness and successful, popular working relationships. Because it wasn't just us, it was the entire creative team, more or less, that both got the email at the same time. And that is, I think it's a worry. But the fact that that's happened so quickly and it felt to us so ruthless, really, and a kind of coldness. And it's like, this isn't what theatre should be. There aren't enough perks to be treated badly.
I'm sure it's true for Everyman as well. It certainly was true for Nottingham. But those theatres rely on that show to survive the rest of the year. It's the only ticket they sell that's a surefire.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was an article in The Guardian a while back, and according to them, the Everyman was taking 26% of their box office income across the two theatres. So that's a quarter of their entire income, which is an astonishing thing.
Which, of course, gives management then the opportunity to perhaps do more risky or challenging work elsewhere in the year. I guess if you want to have flexibility in your programming and not have to worry about box office quite so much, having the sort of security of a hit panto must make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do either of you feel the pull to be back on stage in a frock?
I think now the Liverpool's got them, yes. Ah, hello, Satan. Where do I sign?
Yeah, I could find a fairy in me, but I do really love the writing process. And so I think, will we go on stage again? I mean, we both have acting agents and, if you get that call, yeah.
I think the aim now is so extraordinary. I mean, I think I probably could have another stab at that because I'm
sure
loved
you
it.
Could.
I really, really loved it.
I would definitely come and see that.
Yeah. And also, because it's never, for me, the day to speak about an eccentric antic. It's something else and it's a kind of heartbeat of what the pantos are a lot of the time. So, yes, maybe. Yeah. Never say never.
To encourage you, I have to say you are the funniest and the most lovable dame I have ever seen. up there with, I've seen some dames.
That's so lovely.
With all due respect to Ken as well.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
That's
listen,
so nice.
We wish you the very best of luck. I think it's time for the quick fire round, which is just a series of short questions which you can answer succinctly or you can elaborate if you wish. But the intention is just to sort of do a sprint for the finish line. So number one, in the context of panto making, Do you have favourite tools?
Imagination.
Good. Mark?
Actors we've worked with a long, long time.
Yes. Very good.
Can you name a show or production that had an influence on you?
Ronnie Corbett and my dad, that panto, but also playing the Lion and Wizard of Oz at school. One of the girls in the company pulled my tail off by accident, and in my Lion costume, the whole tail came off, and it got a huge laugh, and I went off and they stuck it on again with some, and I came back on, and I just, I don't know why, but I said I'd been to the tailor's, and rather terrible ad lib at the time, but anyway, it got a laugh, and I remember thinking that sense of funny and it being a bit naughty that I'd said something that had been in the script.
And thus began a career.
Yeah. What's laughing me called?
What about you, sir?
Ooh.
Being a spider in the Nativity, surely, Stan.
Well, yeah, no. So when I was about four, I was a spider in the Nativity, and everybody else was angels and shepherds, and I was in black tights and a leotard, and I remember being so cross on stage that I made a point of going to the front of the stage and falling asleep. It was like, go there.
I have to share this with you. My friend Chris, who I had a theatre company with for a short while after university, his stage debut was also in a Nativity, but he had to be a rock in the Nativity. And he had to wear brown corduroys and a brown polo neck, and he came on and basically curled up in a ball. That's how they used to have the excess children.
That's why him and I are in therapy together.
That's brilliant.
What's your favourite bit of the process?
It's so buried. Even the quiet walks down the canal, like the start, I see it like a painting, and there's a few splatters. And then as it develops, I think the whole process, then the designer comes on board and you get into that rehearsal room, the tech, and you get it on stage. It is a wonderful journey, starting from a blank canvas to how it ends up.
So all of it.
Basically.
Okay, is there any bit you don't like?
Yeah, an email of Friday
afternoon at 5 o'clock.
Okay. Sorry, how about Mark? Is it the same answer? Do you have a favourite bit, a particular favourite bit?
I really enjoyed the read through.
Ah.
I really love hearing it for the first time and how we heard those actors saying it. And if it's close, and it can do better with it, stuff like that. I really enjoyed it.
Fascinating.
Even though I find it an all terrifying at the same time. So I do enjoy it.
So if you could have a rider like a rock star does to get you through the tech rehearsal period of the show, what would be on your list?
Oh, I think probably what they do at the ball, they have a huge basket of chocolates and fruit.
That's good to hear.
That helps. Chocolate.
Yeah.
And more time as well,
more
maybe.
Because it's split between, obviously, us, the director, the musical director and choreographer.
Yeah.
So it is time. I think that's more really time. Good.
Mm. If you were in charge, what one thing would make working in theatre better?
Not getting an email at 5 o'clock. <I tell you. laughs>
Say no more.
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I think that if every department is about respect and kindness, I think if that runs through, and it certainly has been my experience of theatre for many, many years, that joyfulness and respect of each other and everyone's job. And, obviously the results of recent years, that's been slightly the question. And I've seen it happen at other places as well. You know, think, how's that happened? And so if I was in charge, I would make sure those things happened in a way that was slightly more thoughtful, I suspect.
Mm. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
I got one more crucial question. Pudding or cheese?
Cheese.
Pudding.
Oh, I see. So you eat. That's quite clever.
As pudding, one has cheese.
Yeah.
And then you could just sort of swap across the table. Very good. I think it's James's round now, actually. He's going to fight his way past the hordes of children demanding glowing wands and bags of sweets. He's going to try and sidestep the parents at the bar negotiating who's going to drive home. What can he get you?
Quite a Guinness for me, please.
I would have said if I hadn't had yesterday a pint of cider.
So. You're off cider for a couple of days.
I overwear a couple of days. For overexcitement and indulgence.
They're yours.
Lovely.
Thank you very much. I hope we'll buy you those in real life very, very soon. Wonderful, guys. Yeah. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant.
Yeah. It was really lovely to have a chat about it.
The Making Theatre podcast is compiled, produced and edited by Bruno Poet and myself, James Farncombe. As ever, if you have any questions, comments or even ideas for future episodes, you can contact us on Instagram or Twitter at Making Theatre FM, or if you prefer, by email on makingtheatrepodcast@gmail.com. We are doing this for fun and also hopefully to contribute to a broader awareness of everyone's role in the industry. So we do all the hard work. All you have to do is spread the word and take a moment to leave us a glowing review on your favourite podcast platform. Seems like a pretty good deal to me, and we'll be very grateful. Until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.